this is Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology understandable with tips and information for you and your family to make your lives easier. Tonight, my very special guest is Dr. Ann Swanson Ledbetter, and we are going to be talking about PTSD, what's involved with it, how to recover from it, how to get help. I'd like to give you a little information about Dr. Swanson Ledbetter. She received her doctorate in ministry and theology from King's Seminary and her Master of Divinity with a concentration in marriage and family therapy from Fuller's Theological Seminary. She's been licensed for 29 years, having taught and counseled in Palestine, worked for Focus on the Family, and served as adjunct faculty at Azusa Pacific University and Hope International University in Southern California. She was full-time core faculty at Argosy University in the Orange campus, also in Southern California, for the past 5 years and is now the chair of the Counseling Psychology Department. Her specialties include trauma and the dissociative spectrum, integration of psychology and spirituality, parenting and healing from sexual abuse, and transformational work in prisons. Welcome, Dr. Swanson Ledbetter.
Yes, thank you, Julianne. You know how sometimes when somebody reads something about you, you go, who is that person? Thank you.
Yeah. I know. You've done spectacular work.
Thank you. It's been a joy, and I've learned a lot along the way.
Yes, I would imagine. It's quite the extensive background. You sent me your biography and also your resume, and it took my breath away, really.
Oh, thank you.
So,
a lot of cool opportunities.
Yes, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, how did you get into working with PTSD?
Yeah, great question. I think life's a journey, and you kind of take one step at a time, and different doors open up. But in my background, heading towards being a therapist and being interested in helping people who are in pain, I started working with children and adolescents, and particularly adults in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who had been abused as children. And as is so common, sometimes those things are repressed or put out of someone's memory while they can't cope with it, but in their older years when they have more strength and more capability to recall things and deal with things, some of those traumas start coming back. So in my work with women particularly who were in their 30s and 40s that had been abused as children, the memory started emerging in the work, and I started thinking, oh my gosh, I've got to do more learning and studying and understanding how to support some of the trauma that has been embodied in these people's lives. So I started doing a lot of workshops and going to different courses and reading some of the great writers who had discovered many things about PTSD and trauma, and particularly about body work and some of the nonverbal ways even of helping people. So that was part of my journey, and I just started down that pathway and learned a lot, and I've had the privilege to work with a lot of very powerful, amazing people who have gone through a lot of hurt in their life and have done a lot of recovery. And I've seen people go from some of the most extreme circumstances I've ever experienced to, you know, very fully functioning people as part of society because of their work and healing. So, yeah, that's how I started, was basically working with people who had been sexually abused in their childhoods.
So that opportunity just kind of opened up in front of you, and you just had so many clients that presented with some form of PTSD then, right?
Right, yeah, and I think the statistics show that 5 out of 8 girls at least go through some kind of sexual abuse or trauma in their life, and those are horrifying statistics, but at least that's what they say, and then maybe the statistics are about 2 out of 8 boys, but we think it's probably even higher because boys will be afraid of being labeled in certain ways as being gay even if they're not, and of embarrassment and talking about abuse. So it's probably higher for boys. So it's so prevalent in the history of people. I think as you start to meet with people and talk with people, it comes up a lot.
Right, and it's so full of shame and hurt and secrecy that to get that information out, and I agree with you that it, those are probably low statistics because that tends to be a crime that is underreported.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And especially when it's within the family and children are trying to struggle with this, you know, person that's taking care of me on one hand and maybe is nurturing in certain ways, and then these other experiences where they're not nurturing and when they're doing things that don't fit with the role of being a good caregiver. It's very difficult for a child to put all those pieces together, and maybe they don't talk about it because of that.
Yes, and also cultural roles. What is the cultural norm for reporting something like that? Certain cultures, I'm sure that they don't report at all.
Yes, I think that's very, very true. And really, you know, being a little older and practicing for a long time, I've seen a change in the 30 years that I've been doing therapy that it's become more common because of our law changes and because it teachers and other people in the society are mandated reporters, and we're looking for it more, and it's more of an open discussion maybe in the last 10, 15 years than it was certainly when I first started, and children are being more believed or it's being more investigated. So that helps at least create more of an atmosphere. There weren't any children's books on it when I first started in this work, and now you can, you know, go to Barnes & Noble and find children's book on safe touch and what's bad touch versus good touch, and put in children's language to help them at least identify that they have a right to have a voice and to tell somebody if something that has happened to them is not something that they feel comfortable with. So that's really shifted in even the American culture, and certainly, you know, in our society in the last 30 years. But yes, you're right. Different pockets certainly would have more openness to that than others in different cultures and different groups.
Yes, and I agree with you that there seems to be more of a more media available for this. We're talking about it more. If not on TV, on radio, on, you know, the books, like you said, that are available. That's wonderful to have that kind of information out there and available, because a decade or two ago, that was non-existent, or you really had to go through certain different realms to be able to get that kind of information. It was still pretty much a taboo subject to talk about. Any kind of trauma seemed to be kind of taboo. It's, you know, so I'm happy that this is opening up and we are starting to talk about it in a society, because I think this is where we're going to see that paradigm shift.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's how I started. Then as I moved into more of understanding of some of what happens to the brain and the body with trauma, I started doing more studying on different methods of how to support people that have had traumatic experiences. And some of that was body work, which is very different from traditional talk therapy. It's more in utilizing the body to let go of symptoms and things that the body's held on to for a long time. And so it's more of physical work, or maybe helping people understand the stresses that are in their body and how the body patterns might be holding stresses. And so there's different techniques that have been used to help with the nonverbal part of trauma and PTSD. And so I started studying some of that another technique called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization reprocessing, long, long title,
yes.
By a woman named Francine Shapiro that has been well researched for the last 15 or 20 years that have helped a lot of people that have had post-traumatic stress or trauma in their background, and is really commonly used now more with veterans from war and from some of the natural crises that people go through.
So can you tell the audience a little bit about what is involved in EMDR?
Sure. Yes. If I had my hand, and if we were on TV, I could show you, but I'll try and describe it on radio, is if you put your hand into a fist and put your thumb in the center of a fist, that is could be a representation of your brain, and your thumb would represent a part of the brain called the amygdala, and that's a very powerful part of our brain that holds trauma and very strong memories. And the interesting part about that is it doesn't have time. So if something happened 25 years ago and it was very traumatic to you, it would could be as if it happened yesterday or in the moment. So when a car will backfire around a veteran who experienced a lot of war trauma and bombs going off, the veteran can experience it as if they are back in Iraq and a bomb's going off. And so that brain part is to protect us and help us to survive. And so it keeps a hyper alert, high energy, high cortisol, high adrenaline running in our body so that we don't get killed or hurt. And so when someone's been through a lot of trauma, that part of their brain is activated all the time. And I raise up my four fingers and my fist, and so it's always, like, activated and on alert. And so that's what happens with someone when they've been through a lot of trauma, unless they get some treatment that helps clean out that part of the brain, which will hold on to things and say, you're always in danger, you need to always look out, you need to always be aware. And so that's one of the signs of PTSD and post-traumatic stress is when someone has flashbacks from things that have happened a long time ago, but they feel like they're present, and they activate a very hyper-alert, very high awareness and high vigilance in the body. Mm-hmm. That's a simple description of it. And EMDR is a technique that was developed by Francine Shapiro that helps go to that part of the brain and the memories and helps separate out the feelings from the experience. So people don't forget that something happened in Iraq, but what they'll feel like it's in the past instead of in the present. And so that's what it does. And the technique is basically called bilateral stimulation. I don't want to get too complicated here, but basically it helps reprocess through what got stuck in the body and the brain when the trauma happens. When we experience really strong trauma, our body holds things, and another writer would talk about it as body movement, body sound, and body breath. And so we actually hold our breath, we might freeze in our movement, and we will hold things in tension, and they don't get released. And so EMDR is one way of, like, releasing that. And the techniques are by either a movement of the hand that makes and that directs the eyes to go back and forth in a pattern, or there's a machine that has a light bar that has a light that moves back and forth, or I actually do the tapping on someone's hands or someone's knees that also do the bilateral stimulation. So it's a process that helps the brain process through what got stuck in the trauma. Does that make sense?
It does. That's a really good explanation of it.
And it's easy to see. Maybe there's some videos on YouTube and some other things that show therapists doing EMDR, which watching it's, you know, probably worth a thousand words, but seeing the demonstration of it. So what the therapist does is they talk about the incident that caused the trauma. They find the belief patterns that would be true for someone, like I'm going to die or I'm not going to survive this, and the emotions that go with it, which would probably be terror and fear. And then they do the movement, the eye movement or the tapping or the light bar. And in focusing on that memory, that bilateral stimulation helps move those experiences that are held in the kind of emotional trauma out of the amygdala and into more of the left brain, which is more of the cognitive part that can see, wow, that happened 10 years ago. I'm not in danger now while that car is backfiring. But I was in danger 10 years ago, you know, when a bomb exploded. So it helps to separate the past from the present and helps people to live in what's real for them in the moment.
So, in other words, they don't get triggered as easily after they go through these sessions.
Yeah, and I would even use stronger words than that. Some of the research that's been done on EMDR, that 80% of Vietnam vets, when this was first done 15, 20 years ago on Vietnam vets, 80% of Vietnam vets stopped having flashbacks in 1 to 2 sessions of EMDR.
Amazing.
And those flashbacks did not return a year later, and then 2 years later they also did a study. So it's not just they're less. For 80% of people, they were actually gone, and they didn't have that reaction. So that's what made this technique so astonishing in the research, is it is so effective for people.
That's wonderful. Now, does it make any difference as to how long they have had that trauma hanging around?
Great question, Julianne. You're so intuitive. What a great student you are. Yes, there are categories that we talk about trauma, and there are categories called more simple traumas or more complex traumas. And for instance, poor San Francisco and Napa Valley that just went through an earthquake a couple days ago, not that that would be less traumatic than anything else, because it certainly can be really scary when you're in the middle of a 6-point earthquake.
Yeah, especially at 3:30 in the morning. Yeah,
so we call it a simple trauma in that it's a one incident time. And so if you compare that to maybe a 4-year-old little girl who had sexual abuse from someone in her life for 5 or 7 years, maybe every weekend when they were away with an uncle or something like that, that would be more of a complex trauma, and it's more complicated in terms of how someone relates to it and how they adjust their life. So yes, in the simple traumas, the EMDR works fast and quick, and almost maybe 1 or 2 sessions often takes care of any of those symptoms of flashbacks or fear or hypervigilance. In the more complex traumas, it might take longer or some different a few different sessions to address the different kinds of issues that come up with that.
And do you find that different people react to the EMDR work differently because of the different traumas that they've experienced? I mean, you know, one technique does not fit all, from what you have been explaining, for the different types of EMDR.
Yes. If I'm hearing your question right, do you mean like to select whether I tap on someone's knees or use a light bar? Or
yes.
Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Yes.
I find some people, they call them learning channels. So even in the classroom, teachers are quite familiar that certain people will be more attuned to a visual stimuli. So they'll write on the board, and that person will learn better with the visual cues. And some people are more auditory, so they'll learn better and faster through recordings or through the spoken word in the lecture. And some people are more kinesthetic or physical, and they'll learn better by doing things and by, experiential work. So part of when I select how I'm going to work with the EMDR, or whether I'm even going to use a different technique than EMDR, because there's a couple other ones too, is I'll think about someone's learning channels, and I'll listen to their language and how they describe things. And words portray how people perceive and think things. So if I hear someone saying, I see this a lot, or I have a vision of this, or I really can visualize the colors in that, I listen and hear that they're more visual, so I might use part of the EMDR or a different technique that has a more visual component to it. So, yeah, people are different, and not everybody responds the same, definitely, to treatment. I think that's part of the art of being a therapist, is tuning into that particular individual and what their needs are and what works for them.
Yeah, definitely being in tuned and intuitive, as you had brought up before.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a while, and luckily you have many years of getting that art and technique down, which is great.
Yes, I love it, and I learn every day too. It's a never-ending learning journey.
And there is a newer
technique that's starting to be researched that I wanted to tell you and the listeners about, because I've been studying it myself, and I've brought about 20 of my students that have started to study it with me from this area in my university, and it's called ETT, and it's Emotional Transformational Therapy, and it's similar to EMDR, but it uses light and color, and some of the same principles apply to the trauma, but it uses the variations of color, which seem to respond to different kinds of trauma and the way that they're housed in the body. So it's really interesting that our feet would feel different than our stomach. And so they're going a little bit deeper with some of the variations of where the trauma, where you feel the trauma in your body, and then how color and light can help process that trauma through. So that's a newer one that we're doing a lot of research with to see if it can have the same or even better, you know, impact than the EMDR does. But I do want to highlight EMDR is just an amazing technique, and ETT has a lot of exciting new possibilities. The founder of that, Stephen Vasquez from Texas, has been doing a protocol with addictions, and he's able to work with people who have cravings for alcohol or drugs and stop some of the cravings like immediately and having long-term effects with that. So that's a really exciting possibility to me that we could help impact people who struggle with addictions with, you know, a couple sessions of this light and color work. So I'm very hopeful about the future with that, and we're going to be doing some research to see, you know, how that works for a lot of different kinds of people.
Yeah, that sounds like a great therapy, because the whole situation is a lot of people who have been through trauma self-medicate. Either through substances or alcohol. And do you find that that's a pretty high rate of those, you know, that pairing of having gone through trauma and then self-medicating?
Yes, yeah. And I don't specialize or focus in substance abuse, and I usually, if that's the primary issue, I actually refer that out to people, because there are people that are much better at that than I am and that work with the 12-step programs and specialize in that. So if that's the primary issue, but quite often with trauma, yes, we'll walk in and out of different people that are self-medicating with alcohol or drugs. And in some of the work we did in prison, I also saw a huge correlation to a lot of the people that were imprisoned were there for alcohol and drug offenses or robbery or murder while on alcohol or drugs. And then when we dug a little bit deeper into some of the work, there was quite a bit of history of trauma and violence in their younger years or sexual abuse in their younger years. So you look at the snowball effect of that. You experience trauma and again, not as an excuse for doing anything, but as an understanding of some of what happens when people have experienced a lot of trauma. Then they start to drink or drug or try and numb things out. Then they do things, you know, on drugs or alcohol that have violated laws, and then they get put in jail. So a lot of the work that I've seen also that's been so effective in the prison work has been helping people really learn about the 12-step program and committing to being clean and sober when they're out of prison so that they don't reenact some of that. But definitely the brain needs to numb stuff out. If it doesn't have any other way of doing it, people might choose alcohol and drugs to cope with some of the overwhelming feelings and the flashbacks and some of the trauma that they do experience.
Yeah, and it's understandable to hear. Mm-hmm. I've worked with traumatized clients before, and then you can understand why they have done what they're doing. It's, you know, once they start opening up and really letting you know about their life story, and then you kind of, okay, now I can understand how this happened. You have a much...
And I think that's what's so exciting about, I love that the 12-step program works through things, and it's to help people, you know, stop using, but also to get down deeper and not just have people switch addictions or just say, I have to control everything, but to actually understand and work through the trauma so that maybe even, you know, the cravings or the addictions go away, that they're not just having to fight it and say no, but that actually something could be processed through so that there isn't the craving or there isn't the desire to medicate. I think that's both steps are so important, but if we could actually eradicate the cravings or the need to numb out, that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, most definitely, and it has to almost go in that direction for them to completely heal.
I believe so. Yeah, I definitely do.
Well, Dr. Ann, we are going to take a little bit of a break here, and if the audience would like to call in, the number is 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. And when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about dissociation, okay?
Great. Thank you.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com. And welcome back to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Dr. Ann Swanson-Ledbetter. And we're discussing PTSD this evening. Dr. Swanson-Ledbetter, can you talk to us a little bit about what dissociation is?
Sure, yes. I'd like to start with just the clarification that we all dissociate. And that's been a surprise to a lot of my, even my husband, who he thought only people that were put in mental hospitals would dissociate. Are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. There's a beeping going on. Okay. So dissociation, in my understanding, is the brain's process of protecting us from things that are overwhelming. So one of the ways I think about it is your house has wiring and circuitry in it, and my house is kind of poorly wired. So when we have two or three hair dryers going with the girls in my house, or a dishwasher going, or a washing machine going all at the same time, we have a very effective circuit breaker that actually turns everything off and says, if you keep going, you're going to overload the circuits at our house. And then we have to unplug things and go outside and reboot the whole system. So the brain works much like that. And so when we're emotionally flooded or overwhelmed with things, there's a way and a process that our brain can protect ourselves, and we might put things in categories or separate a little bit out from our emotions or our feelings. And at the smallest end, or the least intrusive end of the dissociative spectrum, as I call it, we all go through something called highway hypnosis. So if I'm driving from my job home, I'm usually not concentrating on exactly which route to go, because I've done it every day for the last 5 years, and I automatically know where to drive. And so that frees my mind to think about things from the day and who I talk to and conversations that I've had with other people. So that would be a type of dissociation, meaning I can separate out what's really happening in the present, and I can focus on something else, but my body is driving home. So that would be something all of us would do and experience, and that's, we don't call that abnormal or dysfunctional. We all do it, and it's a way that we can multitask and do a variety of things. As you go more extreme, dissociation would start to what we call splitting, or what I call splitting, and it would be where different parts of you would hold different emotions or feelings, and they would separate from each other rather than being kind of an integrative whole. So at the far end would be what we used to call multiple personality, and we now call dissociative identity disorder. But the idea is that the people that experience this have been so traumatized in their childhood, and it's quite often related to sexual abuse or some extreme trauma, and the idea is that they've had to split off parts of themselves and act as if things are normal. So the example we used a little earlier with a little four-year-old girl who's being molested maybe in her home, she's got to pretend that everything's normal when she's in front of other people and then figure out what to do with this part that doesn't make sense. And so dissociation is a way of kind of splitting different parts of reality from each other. And that's a simple explanation of it, but I think it's helpful for us to realize that all of us do dissociate a little bit in order to function and multitask, and that's not unhealthy. But when it gets to the places of not being able to be the same in most situations, or have extremely different emotions or feelings or reactions or even memories that don't relate to each other, that's where we see that it starts to cause some problems in life and in relationships for people.
Yes, and also what's called a dissociative fugue is when your body or your brain leaves your body, basically, and you end up someplace else and you don't know how you got there. And
right.
and
right.
you're lost. You're out there and that's caused from extreme trauma, correct?
Yes, yes. And that's where people, when you start to try and understand where people are at, those are some of the questions you would ask them. And I think, again, even that's, we've begun to normalize that rather than say, well, that's something really strange. We're realizing that does happen with severe trauma or extreme situations, that that's the body and the brain's normal way of coping to protect itself and to not be flooded or overwhelmed. And I really appreciate that understanding from World War II, when veterans started coming back and having PTSD and symptoms that didn't have a lot of explanation. A lot of our field began to research and understand that this, you know, was a normal reaction to what people had been through in war and in trauma situations.
And in leading from that information, can you talk to us about your experiences in Afghanistan?
Yes, I would love to. About 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Afghanistan for about 8 days and work with a American company that was there working with Afghanistan people that in a business capacity, but they had lost a couple of their staff in a Taliban murder where they'd been up working with a village doing an eye clinic, a medical clinic, helping people with eye surgeries. And they were driving back from northern Afghanistan and were pulled over by the Taliban, and all 10 of the people were shot immediately. And two of these 10 people lived with the people that I went to help. And they were pretty traumatized. Every day in Afghanistan often is traumatic. So this wasn't just one incident. There's also bombs going off quite often. There was a lot of protection. Well, I can go into that story later. But, yeah, so this was just one incident of trauma, and it was a pretty deep one because one of the women was roommates with the owner of the company. And so she asked if I would come over and do EMDR sessions with whoever would like to have that done of the staff. And there were 40 staff that worked in this company. And in 8 days, I did about 45 to 50 sessions of EMDR.
Amazing.
Was able to train 3 or 4 people that were doing some coaching there to do some basic steps of the foundational steps of EMDR, and do a workshop and educational experience on what trauma was and how the body and the mind react to trauma so that they could have some understanding of that. And it was just such a privilege to do those sessions and to see the experiences and the shifts that happened, you know, really in 1 or 2 sessions for people. So it was a really powerful experience.
Yes, powerful. And I bet you were exhausted at the end of that.
You know, I expected to be, but I actually wasn't. So I have realized this profession is totally the right one for me, and I'm pretty extroverted. So when I get doing something that's about healing and I see good results and I get to be with people, I actually get energized by it. So I really wasn't tired by the time I came home. What I was thankful for was that nothing serious happened in the 8 days I was there. The night before we flew in to Afghanistan, Kabul, Afghanistan, from Dubai, there were helicopters over the house we stayed in, and there was shootings, and there was, and then the day after I left, there was also a bomb explosion at the International Continental Hotel. So it's an ongoing place of a lot of trauma and difficulty, but those 8 days, I didn't experience any of that, so that was, I felt quite protected in that way.
Yes, guardian
it's
angels on that
country,
trip.
And I heard amazing stories of people that were very heroic and had done amazing things to try and bring peace to the country and to really work for the betterment of the country.
Yeah, what incredible work. Are you planning on going back?
I would love to. That company actually does not exist at this moment in Afghanistan. Some of the international politics and things that happened, they're not present right now, although some of the people I worked with are there in different capacities. So there might be a possibility of that. That group of people also do a lot of international work in different countries. So I may go to some other countries to do that. I got to work in Palestine and in Israel for 2 years in the earlier part of my career. So I really love that part of the world and see a lot of possibilities for working with people in trauma in the Middle East, because there is so much trauma and so much war that goes on.
So how do they present to you for being clients, especially, I would imagine, again, culturally, there is a lot of secrecy. Am I correct?
Yes, yeah. That's a great question, because there's a lot of variety amongst the 40 different people in session. Some were American, some were international, some were European, so there was a lot of different cultures represented. What I did need to be very culturally sensitive to, especially in the tapping on someone's hands or knees, was in the Muslim culture, it's usually not okay for women to touch men that aren't related, are married to each other. So I usually do the tapping, so I had to switch to the eye movement and be really sensitive and ask, you know, what would be most comfortable. I did need a translator for one or two people, but most people I could work with in English or broken English, so that worked okay. There was one person who I probably won't share a lot of the details, but he was involved in some of the security issues that went on, and so on some of that I could tell that some things he was having a body experience, but he wasn't comfortable sharing what he was thinking or feeling. So I just didn't ask a lot of questions. I let it be his own experience, because I could see he was in conflict with what he could share and what might be dangerous politically for him to share. So I'm, for that person particularly, I'm sure it was pretty complicated as things come up, because you, in EMDR, you don't filter a lot of things. You just have reactions. So, and the nice thing about that technique and the emotional trauma transformation therapy is it can just be on a physical level too. So people don't have to share. They can have their own internal experience and still receive healing and freedom from it without having to share or divulge a lot of things.
Which I'm sure made them feel more comfortable that they were able to do that. They had the choice of whether to be verbal or not, because sometimes with trauma, it's so deep and it almost goes beyond words. So to be able to take it from a body perspective and work with it has got to be powerful.
Yes, yes. And that does remind me of my work in Israel. I worked with quite often the second and third generation of Holocaust survivors, but their parents who had gone through the Holocaust or their grandparents would not talk about what they went through, that part of the survival for some of that generation that had gone through the horror of the camps, they did not want to talk about it and would not talk about it. And so then we get the children and the grandchildren who are feeling the effects of trauma in their family, but nobody will talk about what happened. So that was a really interesting process, too, to help the children and the grandchildren realize that, you know, even though it affected them, it wasn't something you could go push their parents or grandparents to talk about, because part of the not talking about it might have been their survival. And that it's not always the best thing to talk about. People have to be ready to talk about it, and they have to feel strong enough and capable enough to talk about it without being re-traumatized.
Right, and enough trust has got to be built up, and them being able to be comfortable with the process. And you're right, not re-traumatizing them, being able to let them go at their own pace.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, that can be tricky sometimes.
Yeah, and so I'll say to my clients, look, this is just you stick your toe in the water and you tell me when it's okay and when it's not okay. And you're never pushed and you're never told to do, you know, that you have to do anything or you have to talk about anything, because it can actually set that circuit breaker in motion again. And so, it's really important to follow someone's lead and where they're comfortable going.
And then in a situation like that, is it typical for them to dissociate to a certain degree?
People have, and they can, yes. And I have a client who's given me permission to talk about her experience. I had worked with her for over 10 years, actually. And, excuse me, she would have a part of her that would actually, we called it pull the plug. So if something got too traumatic or too overwhelming, she would actually kind of, I don't know how to describe it, her chin would drop down to her chest, and she would look like she was going to sleep. And the first time it happened, it was really frightening to me as a therapist. I'm like, what happened? Did she, is this narcolepsy? Or I was so shocked. But over time, what we realized is that part of her, just when things were too overwhelming, would kind of pull the plug, and she'd lose all her energy and kind of focus, and she would look like she was going to sleep. So we learned over time that she could start to feel when she was getting overwhelmed, and she would say to me, this is too overwhelming, I need to stop. And that was good, that she could start to verbalize when she was getting to that point, and then we could back off of the subject and, you know, talk about something else and return to it later when she felt like she had more control. And I even got, so I could see, there would be this little wrinkle that would go across her forehead, kind of like when someone's confused, they furrow their brow. Mm-hmm. And when that would happen on her forehead, I would say, are you starting to feel overwhelmed? And that was her sign, too, that she was getting confused and overwhelmed. So we were able to work that so that she has never had to do that again once she could verbalize it and learn her body and learn what was too much for her. And so then she started to have control over that. But yes, at first she was actually dissociating in a very dramatic way, which was, now I teach my students about that because no one had ever taught me what to do if that happens. And it was the first time it happened. It was quite shocking and a little confusing for me as a therapist about what was the best thing to do.
Sure. And it's really difficult if that happens towards the end of the session and you have to say, okay, time is up. And all of a sudden you see them starting to dissociate.
Exactly.
And then you know that they're going to get behind the wheel of a car. That could be kind of dangerous.
Yes. Yes. So what I usually have people do is if they feel dissociative or out of their body or not present is maybe walk around the block and focus on things that are current, like what did they have for breakfast and what are they wearing today and can they feel their feet on the floor and can they, you know, tap their shoulder and feel themselves or can they just move. So sometimes just walking around the block before they would get in the car would be a really good direction so that people aren't dangerous behind the wheel.
That would be a little scary to be in that state and then try to go drive, especially in Southern California. It's dangerous anyways, and in that state would be doubly dangerous. So, yes. Okay, we're going to take just a short musical break here, and when we come back, let's talk about some tips for the listeners if they or someone they know and love is going through some PTSD symptoms. Okay.
But all this hugging and all this kissing can't put back together the love we're missing.
We can't keep making up and making up and making up and waking up over again. Making up and making up and making up and breaking up over again.
I know the lyric goes, I've been your fool, but in this case that old line just ain't strong.
Welcome back to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Dr. Ann Swanson Ledbetter. So Dr. Ann Swanson Ledbetter, what would you recommend if someone is listening and going through PTSD symptoms, behaviors, and just are having a difficult time trying to get grounded in their lives right now?
Yeah, I think the first thing is compassion for yourself or for anyone else that, you know, is going through something like that, and not to pathologize or label things, and realize that often those symptoms are either something in the present or something from the past that's coming up to invite healing. So that's the way I always look at it, like the body remembers and is trying to tell us there's something that, you know, needs some attention. And I think that's startling for people when maybe the trauma's been 20 or 30 years ago and they feel it in their 40s and they're thinking, why now? And it's one of the things I usually say to people is that's actually saying that you're strong enough to cope with it and look at things now. So that's actually a positive way to look at it. The other thing is, you know, we have medication in our world for a reason, and I'm not quick to suggest always to medicate everything, especially without working things through in therapy. But medication helps us with when symptoms of either depression or anxiety or flooding, we call it when memories are flooding so strongly that we might not be able to carry on our normal relationships or our work kind of life. So there's definitely advances that we've had in anti-anxiety medications or antidepressant medications that help create a framework where people can work through their traumas so that their symptoms aren't, like, so extreme that they can't even talk about things or carry on life as normal. So seeing a medical doctor or having a consultant with a psychiatrist and or a therapist to help you look at how would you work through some of those symptoms and the underlying causes and possibly medication that might help support the process to work through those symptoms. I think now more than ever in the last 15, 20 years, we've got treatments that are proven to help trauma. And so rather than just saying to a veteran, you're going to have to deal with that for the rest of your life, we have hope and we have you know, techniques that can help that. So finding a specialist that works with trauma or works with EMDR or ETT can be really helpful for someone that's going through some of those symptoms.
Yeah, and being patient with the process. It's not an overnight process, especially with complex trauma.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think there are stories and movies and books that have been written about people's survival and their healing. So I think just to have hope that it's not a condition or a situation that someone has to stay stuck in, but there's many people that have recovered from trauma and very complex trauma and are leading productive lives and giving back to society. And a lot of them have become therapists themselves to help other people or are working with war vets or giving back in different ways that really support that.
Yeah, I'm a complex trauma survivor, so I agree. And it is well worth.
And wow.
Yeah, it is well worth walking through. Sometimes it is scary, but I tell you, the journey at the end is just incredible. It's, you have a new life ahead of you that you never, ever thought you were going to have. I never thought I was going to be at the point that I'm at right now. But I did a lot of hard work.
Powerful testimony.
Yeah. We'll have to talk about that in private.
the place that you have to, shame is, I think, an early stage that lots of people go through, whether it's shame about their symptoms or shame about their experience or fear that no one's going to believe them or fear that nobody understands. So I think often getting through the shame, which isolates us and makes us pull in and makes us not talk about things, is one of the first important steps. So if people can reach out and either, you know, find some hope with someone or share with someone that will understand, I think the shame can start to dissipate. And then one step at a time, you can walk out of that. But I often see shame as so isolating, and people that will come to me for that first session, they'll say, you know, I've held on to this secret or this trauma for 25 years and I didn't want to tell anybody. And, you know, it's such a huge step for people to take that first step and reach out for help or talk with someone about it. And then often people can move through it pretty fast once the door opens, and it's surprising, I think, for people how things can shift so quickly once they take that first step of talking to someone or getting some help.
Right, and then there's that sense of relief that, oh, somebody does understand me now. Now I can sit there and open up. I've got that permission to do that, whereas before they may have been shut down during the process by their abusers.
Right.
So,
and Vivian, it, I'm, I'm so excited, too, that you shared that, because I also think people that have survived trauma are also often the best trauma therapists, right? I just want to encourage you with that, that I think people who haven't been through a lot of trauma, sometimes it's hard to relate, and it's hard to understand the actual physical sensations and the internal process. So, I often think that, like maybe anything else, someone who's been a substance user might relate and work best with people who are working at substance recovery, that in trauma, I think the same thing is true, too, that you know some of it from the inside out, and it helps people feel like you are someone who's trustworthy and who really gets it, sometimes without words.
Right. And as you had mentioned before about 12-step groups, an excellent one is Sexual Abuse Anonymous. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's as popular as like AA or NA or any of the other 12-step groups, but they're out there. And it's amazing to go to those groups and just take the first step in and listen to the other stories. And then you can sit there and go, oh, I can relate to this. I can relate to that. And start taking those baby steps towards healing, because it is so possible.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah, you're reminding me of, I worked with a group of women for 5 years who had all been sexually molested in their youth and childhood. And I just was shocked the group lasted for 5 years, almost every week for 5 years. But that group worked through so many things, and there was so much victory and joy and positive support. And the individual therapy process is a very powerful one, but a group process is also very powerful and supports in ways that individual therapy can't be. And when you get with people who have been through what you've been through to some degree, it really does add a communal support that is helpful.
It does, and it takes you out of that isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Because that can be an element that can just drain you and bring you down, and thinking that I've been the only person that has been through an experience like that. Well, yes, it may be true, because we all go through different experiences at different levels and stuff. But once you start connecting with other people who have been through what you've been through, it is empowering.
Yes. Yeah, I call it believing the lies. And, there's a way that the lies are like, nobody will understand me. Nobody will, love me. Nobody will, get what I've been through. Those kind of lies keep us isolated. So I think that's one of the first hurdles. And it's interesting that the EMDR and the ETT actually address those lies that we tell ourselves and work through some of that. So that's a huge part of it.
Yes. And it is great work. I've done some EMDR work, and it's just... It's great, because it does go, it goes beyond talking sometimes, that it does go to the midbrain and start healing it up from a whole different perspective.
Yeah. And I'm excited that our graduate schools are starting to address that in training for therapists and help expose therapists to talk therapy is really important, and there's other ways to address people too that support the talk therapy, like you said, the body work and the EMDR. So that's an exciting part to me, because going through graduate school, I didn't get that, and then I had to really dig and find it and discover it afterwards. So I really want to expose students to those kind of options so that they can come to, a therapy practice well-versed, or know how to find the tools or the other people that are right for someone if they aren't equipped or educated, and that they know how to refer to people who are. So in light of that, too, one of the tips would be, if you're interested in EMDR, you can look up therapists in your area under the zip code where you live at the EMDR website, and they have therapists who are trained in EMDR all listed there that are certified and come well recommended. So that's a resource for people in whatever area they live in.
Yeah, that's great. And if the audience would like to contact you, how can they do so?
Sure, yes. My private office number is 909-591-9108. I'm also chair of counseling psychology at Argosy University. So that number is 714-620-3630, and I'd be happy to talk to any listeners or refer out to therapists that are good that I know in these areas of trauma.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Dr. Swenson Ledbetter.
Julianne, it was a delight. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. I'd love to have you on again.
All right. Take care. Have a good night.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And if the listeners would like to contact me, you can do so. My email, jgood8@verizon.net. I'm going to be out for a couple of weeks, so you can call me after a couple of weeks. I'm going to be doing some training over in Europe. So thank you so much for listening. And I'd like to thank Jenny Guzman, my board operator, Jeremy Hansen, our executive producer. And thank you so much for tuning in. If you would like to hear this podcast again, you can do so on iTunes under the podcast section on Psych One-on-One. And it will also be archived to SkidRowStudios.com in 24 to 48 hours. Join me almost every Monday night from 7 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And we will go into more psychology themes and issues that you have. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.